This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, meet the hackers who could change everything. So recently, we called up a computer hacker. We caught him in the middle of a huge hacker convention in Las Vegas. It's called DEF CON.
And while you are at the DEF CON conference, you don't use the ATMs, you don't check your email, you don't trust any of the Wi-Fi networks at the conference either. Basically, you don't trust anybody. That's the way it works.
Wow. So you're using like a pen and pad while you're at like this super high-tech conference.
Pen and pad works very well. That's what I recommend when you're at DEF CON.
That's Mikko.
Mikko, with a very long K. Last name is Hyppönen, with a very long P. So
Mikko's from Finland, and he's in cybersecurity, and he's one of the good guys.
I'm a hacker, but I'm the good kind of hackers. And I've never been a criminal. Many guys in this field used to be breaking into stuff. And yes, there are people here who are breaking into systems, not just people who are trying to defend against systems.
Anyway, we pulled Mikko away from DEF CON for a few moments so he could tell us a story that he told on the TED stage about two early computer hackers, the hackers behind Brain.
Originally, I first encountered Brain in 1986.
Brain was the world's first PC computer virus. No one knew where it came from, but they knew how it was spreading.
At the time, people were moving data around on floppies because there was no networks, there was no internet, there was no email. If you had to move something from one computer to another, you copied to a floppy disk and then you moved the floppy to the second computer.
But if that floppy disk was infected with Brain,
you also moved the virus from one computer to another.
And it didn't do anything to your computer. It just sat on it, and you were powerless to stop it. It was a simple virus. And it was actually ahead of its time, way ahead of its time.
It's surprisingly advanced, and it has surprising features, including a capability of hiding itself. So when your PC is infected by Brain, and you go and look at your floppies, you will not see Brain on the floppies. It's watching you, watching it. And if you try to look at the copy of Brain, it fools you and gives you a clean image of a floppy instead. And we would call this a stealth virus at the time.
So Brain came and went, and since it didn't really hurt anyone for a long time, nobody really bothered to find out where it actually came from. Until
2011, when I realized it's going to be the 25th anniversary of the Brain virus, I started looking into it, and I wanted to find out who wrote it. So I went back, because I remembered there was text inside the virus. And sure enough, there was text inside the virus, inside the Brain code. Text in English.
What did it say?
Well, you want me to read it? Well, let me see what I have here. So when you took a Brain-infected floppy and you looked at the very beginning of the floppy, at the boot sector area of the floppy disk, inside the code of the boot sector was this short text which said, "Welcome to the dungeon, 1986, Brain and Amjad." And then it has an address. An address in Pakistan, 730 Nizam Block, Allama Iqbal Town, Lahore. Then it ends with the text, "Beware of this virus. Contact us for vaccination."
Huh, that was very very friendly of them to include all that information in their virus.
Yes, and it's a bit of a mystery. And when I started investigating this again in 2011, I basically looked up the address in the virus on Google Maps. There's still this road in Lahore, in Pakistan. So I decided to go there and find out if the guys are still there.
So a couple weeks later, Mikko's walking down a street in Lahore, Pakistan, looking for the two guys mentioned in the code, Basit and Amjad.
And I tried finding 730, walking down the road, and then I see that there is a building which says Brain on the side of the building. Brain Computer Services. Huh. Obviously, that's the place.
That's a clue, right, at least.
Yeah.
And I knocked on the door. You want to guess who opened the door? Basit and Amjad. They are still there. So here, standing up is Basit. Sitting down is his brother Amjad. These are the guys who wrote the first PC of ours. And of course, we had a very interesting discussion. I asked them why. I asked them how they feel about what they started. And I got some sort of satisfaction from learning that both Basit and Amjad had their computers infected dozens of times by completely unrelated other viruses over these years. So there is some sort of justice in the world after all.
I had heard of these guys for so many years, and of course they made history, so it was really exciting to actually meet them in the real world and shake their hands and speak with them.
So why do they do it? Why do they make it?
Well, that was the key question, and that's exactly what I wanted to ask them. What's the motivation? Why did you do this? And it turns out that the reason was that they had been programmers for years, even before Brain. They had been programming larger computers, Unix-based computers. And then when they started using PCs, they realized that these things are really insecure. And they wanted to prove how easy it would be to write a virus which would completely automatically infect computers and spread around. And Brain proved to everybody that indeed these new PC systems in 1986 had no security whatsoever.
Now, the thing is, if you use a PC today, the security on your computer was developed in part because of Brain, because of what Basit and Amjad created.
These guys weren't evil at all. They weren't evil even then, 25 years ago, when they wrote the first PC virus. Their intention was never to cause harm to anybody. And they didn't, of course, realize that they made history when they wrote the first PC virus. But Brain was the only virus they ever wrote. And they never meant to destroy any data or cause any harm for anyone.
And the thing that bothers guys like Mikko Hipponen is what the word hacker has come to mean, because hackers are bad, right? Well, not all of them. And hopefully, by the end of today's show, you'll agree. Because all of our TED speakers today are hackers for good, hacking into our brains, our environment, even into the DNA of extinct animals. Hackers trying to save the world. So, let's go. What did hacking mean to you when you first started to write about it? Was it a widely used word?
Yeah, hacking had been around as sort of a student spare time, waste of time thing to do. And a hack was just a kind of an amateurish, delighted shortcut. Right through the membranes of standard institutional apparatus.
This is Stuart Brand, writer, environmentalist, hacker. And back in 1984, he was in this incredibly weird documentary. It was called Hackers, Wizards of the Electronic Age. And it kind of explains Stuart Brand's place in the world of hackers.
One longtime supporter of hackers is Stuart Brand, editor of the Whole Earth Catalogs.
They are shy, sweet, incredibly brilliant. And I think more effective in pushing the culture around now in good ways than almost any group I can think of.
To make his point, Brand invited 100 top computer designers to an exclusive hackers conference in this secluded campsite north of San Francisco.
You were like a connector, curator type of person before that became like a fashionable job description.
Yeah. Well, curating is a form of hacking because, in a sense, it's a shortcut to getting other people to do the work.
And to seeing the work, I guess, right?
Yeah, and work in context of each other. What you do is you throw together interesting people and interesting problems and turn up the heat and watch what happens.
So this is where Stuart Brand's story really begins. It's a story about someone named Martha and what she has to do with hacking. We'll get to that in a minute, but first let's meet Martha.
Should we see Martha's house?
Yeah, sure.
We can walk up that way.
We sent our producer, Brent Bachman, to meet the guy who could introduce us.
So she resides in case Z11C.
What are we smelling?
Dead bird. Yeah, birds have, depending on which drawer you open, you'll get some very unique smells.
That's Chris Malensky.
I work in the Division of Birds at the Smithsonian Institution.
He's basically Martha's landlord, and okay, she's a dead bird, but not just any dead bird.
This is sort of a rare occasion where we actually know the exact time of an extinction. Martha died exactly at 1 p.m. on the 1st of September, 1914.
So Martha, who now lives in a climate-controlled case in the Natural History Museum here in Washington, D.C., she was the last living passenger pigeon, the very last of her kind. Passenger pigeons were, at one point, one of the most common birds in North America. And today, like so many species, they're gone. Extinct. And Stuart Brand, he believes he can change that. Here's his TED Talk.
Carolina parakeet. It was a parrot that lit up backyards everywhere. It was hunted to death for its feathers. There's a bird that people liked on the East Coast called the heath hen. It was loved. They tried to protect it. It died anyway. A local newspaper spelled out, there's no survivor. There's no future. There's no life to be recreated in this form ever again. There's a sense of deep tragedy that goes with these things. And it happened to lots of birds that people loved. It happened to lots of mammals. The extinctions still go on. There's an ibex in Spain called the Bucardo, went extinct in 2000. There was a marvelous animal, a marsupial wolf called the thylacine, Tasmania, south of Australia, called the Tasmanian tiger. It was hunted until there were just a few left to die in zoos. Sorrow, anger, mourning. Don't mourn, organize. What if you found out that using the DNA in museum specimens and fossils maybe up to 200,000 years old could be used to bring species back? What would you do?
Well, what Stuart Brand did was decide to bring them back. He joined a movement of scientists interested in something called resurrection biology, or better known as de-extinction. And this is how Stuart explains it.
The ability to basically edit the genes from extinct species into the genomes of a closely related living species and basically turning that living species into the extinct species.
Stuart Brand's plan for hacking into the animal kingdom and bringing Martha back? That's in a minute. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, the hackers hacking into machines and humans, and in the case of Stuart Brand, the DNA of extinct animals. It's a movement of biological hackers called de-extinction.
De-extinction is a hack in a way. Part of what's going on in this century is that it's becoming a biological century, and biotech is at the heart of that, both for doing the science and increasingly for doing the engineering. And my fellow environmentalists made the mistake back in the 80s of becoming averse to genetically modified this and that, and as a result, completely excluded themselves from the cutting edge of important science that relates to everything to do with conservation and various things that environmentalists care about.
I mean, I can't be the first one to say it, Stuart, but I mean, this sounds Jurassic Park-y.
Happily, Jurassic Park is about dinosaurs. Because it's a negative story, all those right. Velociraptors. And dinosaurs are not candidates because they've been gone for 36 million years. And the oldest DNA that we've found is 700,000 years. The good thing about Jurassic Park is it taught a generation of people who are now of professional age that bringing something back from extinction is a cool thing to consider and maybe not out of the question.
Back to Martha, the last passenger pigeon ever. Chris Malinsky at the Smithsonian reads the tag that was tied to Martha's leg when she first arrived at the museum in 1914.
This is a former employee here, maybe having a little fun, actually. But 'twas Martha from the Cincinnati Zoo, most certainly the last of her kind. Mounted skin cataloged under USNM 236650. Hall 13, Birds of the World, Exhibit Case Extinction. Passenger pigeon.
How did this happen? Well, it turns out we used to eat passenger pigeons. They were really cheap, 50 cents for a dozen. And they were so cheap because they were so abundant.
Passenger pigeons were the most abundant bird in America. They might have been the most abundant bird on Earth at the time in the 19th century.
Population estimates were thought to be around 5 billion.
5 billion of these birds. One out of four birds in North America was a passenger pigeon.
You could literally look up in parts of North America and the skies would be black because there were so many passenger pigeons.
Everybody talks about darkening the sun.
Darkening the sky for, you know, a mile wide.
Several hundred miles long would pass overhead.
Passing by for days on end, you know. That's how big the flocks were. It was amazing to think of, just to imagine what that would have looked like. It went from that to just, you know, maybe a few hundred thousand in 20 years.
Because they flock very densely on the ground, they're really, really easy to hunt. And once we had the telegraph and the railroad, it was easy for hunters and netters to slaughter the birds by the ton and ship them to the East Coast. That was done for a period of two or three decades. And by 1900, there were almost none left in the wild. By 1914, there was just one left alive at the Cincinnati Zoo, and this was a female named Martha.
I can turn her around here, if you like.
Again, Chris Malinsky at the Smithsonian.
It was a beautiful bird, and they had a red eye, and then a slightly bluish-gray head and back, and an orangish breast. In a lot of ways, they resemble the mourning dove, which is a common bird here in North America still. They're slightly larger, but they have that long, pointed tail, red feet, and it was a pretty bird. It's been determined now, you know, using genetics, that it was actually most closely related to the band-tailed pigeon, which is still alive in the western U.S. It's primarily a Rocky Mountain species.
Okay, so right here, the band-tailed pigeon, that's where Stuart Brand's story and Martha's story finally collide.
Okay, the closest living relative of the passenger pigeon is the band-tailed pigeon. They're abundant. There's some around here. Genetically, the band-tailed pigeon already is mostly living passenger pigeon. There's just some bits that are band-tailed pigeon. If you replace those bits with passenger pigeon bits, you've got the extinct bird back cooing at you. It's kind of like an evolution machine. You try combinations of genes that you write at the cell level and then in organs on a chip, and the ones that win, that you can then put into a living organism, and it'll work. The precision of this, right down to the individual base pair. Passenger pigeon has 1.3 billion base pairs in its genome. Now, there's work to do. You have to figure out exactly what genes matter. So there's genes for the short tail in the band-tailed pigeon, genes for the long tail in the passenger pigeon, so on with the red eye, peach-colored breast, flocking, and so on. You add them all up, the result won't be perfect. But it should be perfect enough, because nature doesn't do perfect either.
So what else could we bring back?
Maybe the dodo. There's not much specimen tissue, but there may be enough to work with. We could bring back the woolly mammoth. We can bring back the woolly rhinoceros,
wow,
which I didn't even know about.
I didn't either until you just mentioned it, yeah.
This was a northern rhinoceros, the same way that a woolly mammoth was a northern elephant. Saber-toothed tiger, there are in abundance in the La Brea tar pits. And I hear that fencing technology is getting ever better.
We could have like a de-extinction zoo, like the woolly mammoth and the woolly rhino and the dodo. And
yeah, I think you will get a de-extinction zoo on the way to having de-extinction ecosystems.
So, Stuart, I mean, what I would not give to see a woolly mammoth or a woolly rhino who knew even existed.
How old are you?
I'm in my 30s.
You'll probably see at least a baby woolly mammoth.
A baby woolly mammoth in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what I wouldn't give to see those things. But then, like, a part of me, and I wonder if you can understand, like, a part of me is a little bit troubled by it. Like, a part of me thinks, well, God, should we be doing this?
I've been intrigued by how freaked many people are by the idea of de-extinction. Then they come up with all sorts of strange reasons. Oh, we can't bring it back. There's no habitat for it. And, you know, in a few cases, that's true. But in most cases, the habitat is there, drumming its fingers, waiting for these animals to come back. There's an aversion to things that involve genetic tinkering. There's some good reasons for that. But as we bring back some pasture pigeons, and they're adorable, and they fly really fast, and they're persuasive as being like the original bird, or we bring back a baby woolly mammoth, hearts will break. And tears will flow when people see a baby woolly mammoth, and much of the aversion that we felt about how it was brought about, I think, will fall away at that point.
So where do we go from here? These have been private meetings so far. I think it's time for the subject to go public. What do people think about it? You know, do you want extinct species back? Do you want extinct species back? Because the fact is, humans have made a huge hole in nature in the last 10,000 years. We have the ability now, and maybe the moral obligation, to repair some of the damage. Most of that we'll do by expanding and protecting wildlands, by expanding and protecting the populations of endangered species. But some species that we killed off totally, we could consider bringing back to a world that misses them. Thank you.
Stuart Brand. Check out his full talk at ted.npr.org. His group dedicated to de-extinction is called Revive and Restore. Oh, and you can see Martha on display at the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. next year. There's an exhibit planned for the 100th anniversary of her death. David Keith is a climate scientist, and he thinks we might be able to save the planet by hacking into it. And how? Well, here's his proposal from his TED Talk.
You could put fine particles, say sulfuric acid particles, sulfates, into the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, where they'd reflect away sunlight and cool the planet. And I know for certain that that will work. Not that there aren't side effects, but I know for certain that will work. And the reason is it's been done. And it was done not by us, not by me, but by nature.
A desolate and eerie landscape in the northwestern Philippines. It looks like the aftermath of a nuclear holocaust. Instead, it's the wrath of Mount Pinatubo, a volcano that rained down over towns and farmlands, killing more than 300 people, leaving thousands more homeless, casting a shadow over the future.
Here's Mount Pinatubo in the early 90s that put a whole bunch of sulfur in the stratosphere with a sort of atomic bomb-like cloud.
A mushroom cloud of steam, ash, and smoke rose 30 kilometers into the sky.
Pinatubo, like many volcanoes, puts this huge cloud of ash in the air, and that's what people visually see.
As it settled, the debris blotted out the sun and coated hundreds of kilometers of Philippine countryside with what looked like snow.
That ash is not the thing that changes the climate. What you can't see coming out of that eruption is sulfuric acid, or sulfate, that makes it up into the upper stratosphere, where it forms tiny little droplets, a tiny fraction of the size of a human hair, and those droplets become distributed around the whole of the upper stratosphere. And so that reflected away some sunlight.
Cooled the planet.
About half a degree.
And the result of that was pretty dramatic. There's no big mystery about it. There's lots of mystery in the details, but it clearly cools down. And one other thing, it's fast. It's really important to say. So a bunch of the other things that we ought to do, like slowing emissions, are intrinsically slow. So you can't step on the brakes very quickly. But if you do this, it's quick. And there are times you might like to do something quick.
So we can do this?
You could put sulfuric acid droplets in the stratosphere, in the upper atmosphere.
Basically hack the stratosphere.
Yeah. Essentially to make a very thin cloud in the stratosphere. And these would be tiny little droplets like a fine cloud, too small to see, that would reflect away maybe 0.5% or 1% of the sunlight coming in, be pretty much invisible from the ground, but it would cool the planet. So if you warm the climate up by adding carbon, as we've been doing for a century, And then you cool the planet back down to, say, its original temperature by adding sulfuric acid to the stratosphere, this brutally ugly technical fix of adding one pollutant to offset another. If you did that, you could get the globally average temperature back to be exactly what it was, which is an amazing thing.
It is amazing. So how would you get that sulfuric acid into the stratosphere?
That turns out to be really easy. Suppose we want to cut global warming in half. You could start with just two aircraft, two modified fancy business jets that would operate from a single airbase and dump 20,000 or so tons of sulfur into the stratosphere every year. Now, of course, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere is increasing. So each year, if you want to cut the rate of warming in half, you have to keep adding more sulfur. So after a decade, you'd be adding 200,000 tons of sulfur or more. And after 50 years, you'd be adding almost 1 million tons of sulfur a year to the stratosphere, and you would have cut the rate of global warming in half.
You might argue about the sanity of it, but the leverage is real. Let's say that we don't do geoengineering, we do what we ought to do, which is get serious about cutting emissions. And maybe someday, like 2075, we finally reach that glorious day where concentrations have peaked and are rolling down the other side, and we have global celebrations and we've seen the worst of it. But maybe on that day, we also find that the Greenland ice sheet is really melting unacceptably fast, fast enough to put meters of sea level on the oceans in the next 100 years and remove some of the biggest cities from the map. That's an absolutely possible scenario. We might decide at that point that even though geoengineering was uncertain and morally unhappy, that it's a lot better than not geoengineering.
What is it going to take for us to get to that point to try it? I mean, do you think we're going to have to be at crisis point where, like, the oceans are rising really fast and, I don't know, Manhattan, half of Manhattan is under the water?
I have no idea.
Huh.
I think that that's objectively a stupid way to do it. So many people want to frame this as a kind of break glass in case of emergency strategy.
Yeah.
But I think, in fact, you don't want to try an untested technique like this only in case of emergency. You're much better off if you turn it up slowly because you have more chance of figuring out how well it works. So I think we'd be much better to start earlier and do it slowly.
Now, suppose that space aliens arrived on, maybe they're going to land at the UN headquarters down the road here, or maybe they'll pick a smarter spot. But suppose they arrive and they give you a box, and the box has two knobs. One knob is the knob for controlling global temperature. Maybe another knob is a knob for controlling CO2 concentrations. You might imagine that we would fight wars over that box because we have no way to agree about where to set the knobs. We have no global governance, and different people will have different places they want it set. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. It's not very likely. But we're building that box. The scientists and engineers of the world are building it piece by piece in their labs, even when they're doing it for other reasons, even when they're thinking they're just working on protecting the environment. They have no interest in crazy ideas like engineering the whole planet. They develop science that makes it easier and easier to do. And so I guess my view on this is not that I want to do it, I do not, but that we should move this out of the shadows and talk about it seriously, because sooner or later we'll be confronted with decisions about this, and it's better if we think hard about it, even if we want to think hard about reasons why we should never do it.
Say we could do this, right, and it worked. I wonder if it would sort of give us a license, or give some people a license to feel like, well, they could just continue to pollute and not really worry about it.
Of course it will. It's absurdly naive to think otherwise. When you make cars safer by crumple zones and better seatbelts and airbags, people drive relatively faster. When you give people condoms and AIDS drugs, they engage in more risky sex. This is called risk compensation and is a well-known and not necessarily irrational piece of human behavior.
Is there a part of you that kind of feels, I don't know, that, you know, this is kind of like a surrender, that we've failed the planet so much that we have to think about things like this?
Absolutely. And I think that whether or not we ever do this at all, it forces us to ask some big questions about humanity and nature at the scale of the planet, which sounds overblown, but those are the questions we have to answer. We're living in a world where we have powers that give us the ability to treat the planet like a garden. And the question is, are we going to throw the empty cans and garbage in the back and all over it? Or are we going to treat it like a garden we love?
Do you think that this idea of basically hacking our planet to try and save it, it's also a triumph of human ingenuity as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Eli Kintish, a wonderful science journalist, wrote a book called Hack the Planet. He talked about it as a bad idea whose time has come, as if, oh, it's this awful thing that now we have to talk about. And in many ways, that's true, because we're talking about it partly because of our failure to cut emissions. But that seems somehow too... It seems like we're hiding something. We're hiding a genuine, and I think not wrong, joy in the fact that we understand something about the world that potentially gives us the ability to do these things. That understanding of nature gives us power to do great harm as well as potentially power to do good. But the understanding is a triumph of human ingenuity, and I think it deserves some celebration, although people are afraid to do that.
So here's one last thought, that the CO2 problem, the climate problem that we've heard about, is driving lots of things, innovations in energy technologies that will reduce emissions, but also, I think inevitably, it will drive us towards thinking about climate and weather control, whether we like it or not. And it's time to begin thinking about it, even if the reason we're thinking about it is to construct arguments for why we shouldn't do it. Thank you very much.
David Keith is a professor of public policy and engineering at Harvard, and he's the author of the forthcoming book called A Case for Climate Engineering. You can hear his full talk at TED.com. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz. More hacking in a moment here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So our show today, the hackers.
Being a hacker is definitely important to me because a hacker is somebody who doesn't ask how something works. They just see what works.
Jay Silver is maybe the most literal hacker on today's show. He does hack into computers, but he's also an inventor. And what he invented is a hack everything machine. And so you have four bananas here, and each banana will make your Pac-Man move in the direction.
It looks like a cursor key.
Like a cursor key, right? And so with some people we gathered from around the office, we hacked into those bananas to help us play Pac-Man. Here we go. With Jay's invention. It's called a Makey Makey. And it's a little circuit board. It's about the size of a credit card. And it looks...
It's like an old school Nintendo gamepad or basically a video game controller. It's actually a circuit board, but it doesn't look like a circuit board. It just looks like a game controller. And you can hook up alligator clips to it.
And then you hook up those alligator clips to whatever you have lying around.
These bananas are going to get mushy.
Humans, plants, grandmas, kitty cats, water, graphite.
Which then sends signals back through the Makey Makey to your computer.
Just like if you hooked up a regular USB keyboard to your computer and you push the space bar, and the computer's like, oh, the space bar's pushed. So you hook up the Makey Makey, and when you touch the object, that pushes the space bar.
Down, left, down. I'm touching bananas and losing.
One thing you can't do with a normal joystick that you can do here is you can play collaborative Pac-Man.
Oh, that's a good idea. Let's play collaborative Pac-Man.
How do we play?
Just let one person hold the other one, and everyone else can hold hands or earlobes.
And then everybody
Oh, that's awesome.
And at the end, Brent, you're gonna tap the bananas.
We're all gonna get the charge.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Jay Silver's hope.
You're holding that?
I'm holding it.
For the Makey Makey to turn anyone.
It's working. Oh my god.
Okay.
Into a hacker.
I think everyone starts out thinking about the world with what I call a beginner's mind. Which is just a mind that's not trained, doesn't know how it's supposed to think. I think we all start out that way. I think children are like that. Don't know what they are supposed to think when they look at snow or when they look at a TV channel changer or any of these things.
This feels kind of spiritual.
And over time, we're told what to think, and that's useful. We just need to be able to put that aside when we want to.
Thanks, everybody. All right. Okay. You can all go back to work.
Yeah, I don't want to.
That was cool.
Super fun. Do you eat the
yeah.
bananas now?
Or?
We can eat bananas.
Okay.
I think that's what hacking is. It's asking, what happens if I do this? And then doing that over and over again. A kid will try something 100 times, and you're like, why are they trying that? But in trying it over and over again, they're actually exploring the possibilities that we would kind of cut out of our minds because we think, oh, we already know how this works.
Now, believe me when I say you have to see the video of how the Makey Makey works to understand how cool it actually is. And for a very good reason, as Jay explained in his TED Talk, the Makey Makey actually comes with a warning label.
Because otherwise people are going to be getting this and they're going to be turning into agents of creative change and governments will be crumbling. And I wouldn't have told people, so I thought I'd better warn them. And I also put this little surprise when you open the lid of the box. It says, the world is a construction kit. And as you start to kind of mess around this way, I think that in some small ways you do start to see the landscape of your everyday life a little bit more like something you could express yourself with. And a little bit more like you could participate in designing the future of the way the world works. And so, like, you know, next time you're on an escalator and you drop an M&M by accident, you know, maybe that's a M&M surfboard, not an escalator, so don't pick it up right away. Maybe take some more stuff out of your pockets, throw it down, and maybe some chapstick, whatever. And, you know, I used to want to design, like, a utopic society or a perfect world or something like that. But as I'm kind of getting older and I'm kind of messing with all this stuff, I'm realizing that my idea of a perfect world really can't be designed by one person or even by a million experts. It's really going to be 7 billion pairs of hands, each following their own passions, and each kind of like a mosaic coming up and creating this world in their backyards and in their kitchens. And that's the world I really want to live in. Thank you.
Jay Silver, his full TED Talk is really, really great, very visual. You should check it out. It's called Hack a Banana, Make a Keyboard, and you can find it at ted.npr.org.
Oh, I hated this game in the 80s.
A long time before Andres Lozano became a renowned brain hacker, he was actually fascinated by how the brain works, and he remembers the moment that fascination began.
When I was a teenager, I watched a television program about Dr. Penfield.
This is the brain.
Dr. Penfield was a famous Canadian neurosurgeon, and he did epilepsy surgery with the patients awake.
Now, when we stimulated that...
And he was able to stimulate the surface of the brain...
There underneath this...
And in so doing, elicit actions, elicit thoughts, elicit movements, elicit vision.
We stimulated, and to my astonishment, you said, I hear music. Will you hum it now, you remember it?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
While Penfield mapped the surface of the brain, the majority of the brain, of course, is below the surface. And so I was interested in establishing what these uncharted areas of the brain do. So it's really like becoming an explorer, traveling to new lands where no one has been before, and to discover what lies there.
So fast forward decades later from curious teenager to renowned neurosurgeon, and the day Andres Lozano gave a jaw-dropping TED Talk on how he's hacking into the human brain.
Different things. So there are areas of the brain that are dedicated to controlling your movement or your vision or your memory or your appetite and so on. And when things work well, then the nervous system works well and everything functions. But once in a while, things don't go so well and there's trouble in these circuits and there are some rogue neurons that are misfiring and causing trouble. Now, the manifestation of this depends on where in the brain these neurons are. So when these neurons are in the motor circuit, you get dysfunction in the movement system and you get things like Parkinson's disease. When the malfunction is in a circuit that regulates your mood, you get things like depression. And when it is in a circuit that controls your memory and cognitive function, then you get things like Alzheimer's disease. So what we've been able to do is to pinpoint where these disturbances are in the brain, and we've been able to intervene within these circuits in the brain to either turn them up or turn them down. So this is very much like...
How does it work?
Well, we are able to adjust the activity of circuits in the brain by using electricity.
So what we're doing is placing these electrodes throughout the brain. We are making holes in the skull about the size of a dime, putting an electrode in, and then this electrode is completely underneath the skin down to a pacemaker in the chest.
So we are able to go into various circuits, for example, a circuit that controls movement, a circuit that controls your mood.
And with a remote control, very much like a television remote control, we can adjust how much electricity we deliver to these areas of the brain.
We're able to either turn it up if it's underactive, if it's underperforming, or we can turn it down if it's overactive.
So this is very much like choosing the correct station on the radio dial. Once you choose the right station, whether it be jazz or opera, and in our case, whether it be movement or mood, we can put the dial there, and then we can use a second button to adjust the volume.
So using electrical stimulation, we can influence the activity of neurons anywhere in the brain.
Now, the first example I'm going to show you is a patient with Parkinson's disease. And this lady has Parkinson's disease, and she has these electrodes in her brain. And I'm going to show you what she's like when the electrodes are turned off and she has her Parkinson's symptoms, and then we're going to turn it on.
In your TED Talk, you show this incredible video.
So this looks something like this.
This woman with Parkinson's, she's shaking.
Now, and you can see that she has tremor.
What's the right inside?
All of a sudden, the deep brain stimulation's turned on.
It's on.
I just turned it on.
And she stops.
And this works like that, instantly.
What's going on?
What is going on is that there are a bunch of neurons that are troublemakers that are causing the tremor. And so if we're able to pinpoint these neurons where they are, these troublemakers, and say, you know, gentlemen, that's enough, then the tremor goes away immediately. And sure enough, when we place an electrode in the vicinity of these neurons, when we apply electrical stimulation, they can no longer fire in synchrony, and the tremor goes away immediately.
So there are Parkinson's patients around the world who have this implant in their brain whose symptoms are totally controlled?
Indeed, there are 100,000 patients in the world with Parkinson's disease that have these deep brain stimulating electrodes, and their symptoms can be alleviated to a great extent such that some of these patients look perfectly normal.
We realized that perhaps we could use this technology not only in circuits that control your movement, but also circuits that control other things. And the next thing we took on was circuits that control your mood. And we decided to take on depression. And the reason we took on depression is because it's so prevalent. And as you know, there are many treatments for depression with medications, with psychotherapy, even electroconvulsive therapy. But there are millions of people, and there are still 10 or 20% of patients with depression that do not respond. And it is these patients that we want to help. And let's see if we can use this technique to help these patients with depression. So the first thing we did was we compared what's different in the brain of someone with depression and someone who's normal. And what we did was PET scans to look at the blood flow of the brain. And what we noticed is that in patients with depression compared to normals, areas of the brain are shut down. And those are the areas involved in motivation and drive and decision making. And indeed, if you're severely depressed, as these patients were, those are impaired. You lack motivation and drive. The other thing we discovered was an area that was overactive, Area 25. And Area 25 is the sadness center of the brain. If I make any of you sad, for example, I make you remember the last time you saw your parent before they died or a friend before they died, this area of the brain lights up. It is the sadness center of the brain. And so patients with depression have hyperactivity. The area of the brain for sadness is on red hot. It's the thermostat is set at 100 degrees. And the other areas of the brain involved in drive and motivation are shut down.
So on the basis of those observations, we embarked on a study to implant electrodes in Area 25 and turn on the electricity to see whether we could turn down the activity in this area to see whether this would have some benefit in people with so-called treatment-resistant depression.
What did you see, Andres? I mean, with the patients, did they all of a sudden become happy?
So many of the patients will say that they have this black cloud over them, or they have this tremendous weight, this pressure on their chest. And within turning this on within 2 or 3 seconds, that sensation disappears in about 2/3 of the patients.
2 to 3 seconds?
Yeah, it takes 2 to 3 seconds. They say, this burden is lifting. I feel a tremendous relief. And then they start looking around. Then they start becoming more engaged. These are people who often do not leave the house, who sit in a chair all day. And all of a sudden, they'll say, I feel like doing some housekeeping. Or a man will say, I feel like going into my garage and, you know, fixing the car. A tremendous sort of call to action to do things that they were not able to do for many weeks and months. And all of this occurs within 10 or 15 seconds of turning on the stimulator.
You must, on a regular basis, conduct these experiments and come home at night and just think, that was amazing. That was incredible what I just witnessed.
What is incredible is when we go to an area of the brain where no one has been before and we don't really have a good understanding of what it does, and we stimulate there, and all of a sudden we get a totally unexpected finding. A good example of that was when we were treating a patient with obesity by implanting electrodes in the area of the brain that regulates appetite. So when we were doing this experiment on the first human being who had this, as soon as we turned on the stimulator, he told us that he felt he was 30 years younger and was walking through a field with his girlfriend. So we were not anticipating that. As soon as we turned off the stimulation, this memory went away. As soon as we went back at the same level, we were able to recreate this memory. And as we turned up the current, the details of the scene became more vivid. And so he was able to tell us it was a sunny day. He was able to tell us his girlfriend, what she was wearing. We were completely turned around towards looking at an area of the brain where we could unlock a memory of an event that had occurred some 30 years earlier.
It's like science fiction.
It's cartography. It's mapping an unexplored galaxy, an unexplored universe.
I mean, the possibilities must be endless. I mean, you can imagine this technology, I don't know, being used to make people smarter.
If you ask me, is that theoretically possible, the answer is yes.
Wow.
Should we do it? That is something that has a different action. But the idea of altering cognitive abilities, altering personality, is within our reach now. This will then usher what is being called as the era of cosmetic brain surgery, where you will have the possibility of having neurosurgical procedures not to cure a problem, but rather to enhance the performance of a particular cognitive attribute or behavioral attribute. So I don't think that we are ready for that. I think society is not ready for that now.
But I mean, what's wrong with it? I mean, what if someone wanted to become smarter?
Well, there's issues of, you know, distributed justice in terms of who will get this, who will pay for it, for example. Should we be messing with your intrinsic makeup, your intrinsic personality, for one thing? And secondly, who should be making the decisions as to whether you should have this or not? So these are some of the points that need to be considered.
So I envisage that we're going to see a great expansion of indications of this technique. We're going to see electrodes being placed for many disorders on the brain. And I think that we will see that indeed we will be able to chase more of these evil spirits out from the brain as time goes on. And the consequence of that, of course, will be that we will be able to help many more patients.
Andre Sozzano is a neurosurgeon at the University of Toronto. You can find his full incredible talk at ted.npr.org.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many, many more TED Talks at ted.com. And you can download this program through iTunes or the NPR smartphone app. Look for the TED Radio Hour. Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Sanaz Meshkinpour, and Neva Grant, with help this week from A.D. Quigg, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.